Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Jonah Smith, 22 years of combination experience, Battalion Chief 9 with Charlotte Fire Department on B Shift, creator and owner of Hornet Fire Training. Jonah never had aspirations of becoming a firefighter. Law enforcement intrigued Jonah, but it's all about timing when it comes to life. His mother was able to get him in contact with the local fire chief in the area, and from then on, Jonah's journey set sail. The truth bombs and mic drops being said in this interview should hopefully spark a question. If you are being the best version of yourself, not only to you, but to others you work with, meet, and have relationships with. With that, I present Jonah Smith.
I'm Jonah Smith. I'm a battalion chief with the City of Charlotte Fire Department. And currently in charge of Battalion 9 on the B shift. Been in the fire service approximately 22 years in the career side. I've been a volunteer for that exact number of years. Really unique entry into the fire service. My dad wasn't a firefighter. My mom wasn't into the fire department, ladies auxiliary or anything. Had no friends in the fire department. I lived in downtown Richmond. Lived in the Fan area in Richmond, Virginia. And kind of the cool thing about being down there is I got to see fire trucks go by. I got to see police officers. Well, in high school, we had a opportunity during our junior and senior year to do community service. We had to do, I think it was 200 hours of community service, basically no school. It was pretty cool. Some guys went out camping out west and did, learned about how to live off the land and all kinds of stuff. And I said, man, I'm not that guy. So I stayed in Richmond. I volunteered at an adult care facility because my grandma had been in one and I'd seen kind of that environment. And my senior year, I was kind of at a loss what to do. So in December, I was looking around like, man, I'm going to go do police ride along. You know, I'm going to go be a police officer for 2 weeks. I'm going to go ride with these guys because at the time, Richmond was a very violent city. It was number one or number two for per capita murders. And at the time, I was 17, turned 18 in April. Well, the stuff was going on in March. Went down to the police department. They're like, hey, we can't let you ride until you turn 18. We'd love to have you after that. I said, okay, that's not going to work for me. And it just... again, out of nowhere, my mom was a member of the Rotary Club locally. The fire chief, Jack McElfish, was in Rotary with her. She mentioned, hey, I was looking for something in public safety to do. And he said, hey, bring him on down. We'll take him to the Richmond Fire Department. And it was really cool because I was like, man, I get to go ride on fire trucks. Well, I was mistaken. I had to go down because I wasn't 18 yet. I had to ride with the fire marshal's office and wore a suit and tie every day. Dressed up like any high school kid who's kind of doing some job exploration. And it was very interesting because I did a lot, on the support side of the organization, right? Prevention, investigations, the EMS coordinator was in that office. I got to see a lot of cool things. And then I turned 18 and the fire chief came to my graduation party because our families became friends. And he said, hey, man, I got a present for you. And he went over to his take-home fire chief car. And again, this is a, you know, pretty big city department. Richmond is three or so hundred members. And he says, hey, I got something for you. And he handed me a turnout coat that I still have to this day. He handed me a pair of pants and handed me a white helmet, which we know that I'm not wearing a white helmet as an 18-year-old kid going to the fire station. He said, hey, I've talked to Captain Wall at Station 11, which Station 11 is in the Church Hill area of Richmond. Very busy. It was at the time the busiest engine company in the city. Very crime ridden area at the time. It's kind of revitalized now, but and that's kind of where I've gotten my start of wanting to work in those type of areas. And went over there, and on my last day as an intern, I forgot to mention that they sent me to the fire station and said, hey, we're going to introduce you to the fire station, so when you turn 18 and go ride, you can. So I go over there in a shirt and tie to the fire station. You can imagine how that went as an 18-year-old kid or 17 and a half year old kid. And I got berated by the guys for about 20 minutes as I washed the chief's car and missed 100 spots, even though I hadn't missed any spots. got a little feel of the fire service, met some actually lifelong friends, which is funny, being 17, meeting grown men and becoming friends with them. And then, like I said, the chief gave me turnout gear. I went and rode. Another cool part of my journey was I'm sitting there and they say, hey, you're going to paint tools. And they wouldn't let me ride on the calls. I was 18 at the fire station. I was doing dishes. doing all the chores. And I think we all know what that's about. I was kind of earning my spot, earning my seat, and I didn't know it at the time. You know, I just thought these guys are kind of not being nice to me, you know. And they had a tiller because at the time Richmond was switching concepts to the Quint concept, and painted a bunch of tools, got them all ready, and I came in one Saturday ready to ride because they were like, "Hey man, you're going to be able to ride this week." And I walked in the door and the tiller was gone. I was like, "Hey man, where's the ladder truck?" And they're like, "Oh, it went for auction." And I was like, "What about all those tools I painted?" They were like, "We were just seeing if you were going to do it. You're riding in the middle today. There's a portable radio for you because we know you wanted to listen." I said, "Are you serious?" And they're like, "There's your seat. You can ride all the calls a day." And man, I was hooked. During that time, also when I was painting tools one day, the chief Shaughnessy took me for my first call, and I just remember going what felt like 200 miles an hour with a chicken salad sandwich in my hand. He buckled my seatbelt for me, all that kind of stuff, and man, I was hooked. Went down to South Carolina for school, to the University of South Carolina. Worked with the football team as an equipment manager. So anything a player wore, I wasn't a water boy. That was a separate job, but did all the equipment. Worked down there. Was looking at some careers in law enforcement, like maybe Department of Natural Resources, you know, a wildlife officer, ATF, some of those cool things. And I just kept going back to the fire department. I kept going back to the fire department. Kept going back to the fire department in my head. And about my sophomore year, I was like, "I'm going to go be a firefighter." But I went and worked with the football team. Got to work for Lou Holtz directly my senior year. You know, he knew me at practice. If he needed something, he yelled at me. And then went worked with Ray Tanner my senior year and my first year of graduate school on the baseball team. And that's kind of when I had to make a career decision. And I went did an internship with Columbia Fire Department. Did an internship with them for about a year and a half. Did my thesis on firefighter arson, and studied the fire department because again I had a graduate assistantship. So I'd love to go to Eastern Kentucky or Oklahoma State, but that just wasn't in my journey. Because I had an opportunity to work with the baseball team and get my master's degree essentially for free. Did that, and been a Gamecock fan ever since. It's kind of funny, I'm wearing my Gamecock shirt. Nobody else see it on the podcast, but Danny sees it. So I've been miserable my whole life because we always get just right there and then lose or not great. Hopeful this year, but did that, and man, I got hired in the Columbia Fire department as a support member in logistics for about 6 months. Was full-time, still going to school, had stepped away from the baseball program. And then I love hearing our recruits say, "Man, I don't have time to study," because I left auto extrication class in Columbia Fire's recruit school in October, I think it was, to go defend my thesis. So I wrote my thesis during recruit school. I think my thesis is 50, 60 pages. So pretty good with time management, but wrote my thesis, graduated from Columbia Fire, and then as I told you before we got started, kind of explored basically, you know, like any young kid, kind of chasing the money a little bit and just chasing the adventure, right, of the fire service. And I always knew I wanted to work in a big city, and man, I applied in Richmond, I applied in Chesterfield, I applied in Henrico, and Charlotte called first, Richmond called second. Charlotte hired me on, or I got a conditional offer after my interview. They called me back in and said, "Hey, we got a question for you." And I was like, "What did I say that was stupid? And oh my God, I just, you know, said something dumb." And they said, "Hey, do you want to work for us?" And I said, "I absolutely do. That's why I'm here, Chief." And Chief Doolin looked at me and he said, "Can you go for your physical in another 2 hours?" And I said, "Absolutely, I can." I said, "I need you to call Station 13 because I'm supposed to go ride over there." They called Captain McDaniel, who, you know, was one of our division chiefs at the end of her career, but was a captain over there. And that was it. I was hired in recruit class 71 and been in Charlotte ever since. Kind of been mostly on the south side of town. Currently assigned to Battalion 9, which is the new chief that we just put in service just north of Uptown. So I cover right now a third of Uptown, I guess, first due and the rest second due, and then get to run through some of the busiest companies and best officers in our department. So really unique jersey. Again, long journey, long story long about it. But again, my dad was a doctor. I went to private school in Richmond. No interest in the fire service until I set my rear end in the first fire truck, and I was like, "Man, this is pretty damn cool." And learned a lot about life because I was fairly isolated in my life and had some really good mentors in the fire service that kind of exposed me to some real life experiences. How to talk to people that aren't like me, how to relate to people, And that's been a huge part of my journey in the fire service is just, again, learning. There's no better skill for a company officer, in my opinion, than being able to relate to people. And I'm not just talking about the people in the fire station. I'm talking about the people that we serve that sometimes don't appreciate it, sometimes are welcoming, sometimes are not. But it's a really big challenge in some of the communities we serve, right? Because I don't look like or act like or have the same background as some people, but we all have to find common ground during emergencies and frankly, non-emergencies. So that's kind of me.
Okay. Now, you applied at Charlotte, not really knowing anything about the city. You get your phone call, you get your conditional offer, you start a recruit class. What was your experience like?
Well, the first week when they said we had to crawl through an 18-inch pipe, I was like, well, I guess I've done messed up. I'm not super claustrophobic, but I'm not going to say I'm not. And then they're like, yeah, we'll do palm pier ladders. I'm like, what? You know, I was great in Columbia, man. I worked with great people. I was going to fires. I was at Station One, one of the best stations there. And I was like, what am I doing, man? Like, I got to start this over again. And it was great. You know, my class was kind of the transplant class. It was a lot of folks from out of town. I mean, you're from this area. You know, there's like seven people that are actually from up your way, and everybody else is from Ohio, Virginia, New Jersey. So very, very similar experience within my class. We had, you know, I was just, man, like most recruits, right? Just trying to stay under the radar. You know, didn't talk about my experience a bunch in Columbia. You just, again, keep it quiet, man. Just nose down. I'd been through a career recruit school, so I knew what it would look like, right? There was gonna be bad days, there was gonna be arguments. And so they were like, hey, who wants to be the class president? And one of the other guys stepped up, and one of the guys who was on Cleveland Fire and had gotten laid off that was in my class, who since went back, was like, hey man, one of us should take it because we've been through this. I was like, Beagle, you know how this works. He's like, that's why I didn't raise my hand. Well, 2 weeks later, or no, a week and a half in, our training officer comes in and said, hey, our class president quit. We're like, he did what? So of course, Beagle looked at me and he goes, hey man, you're younger than me, take it. So I became our class president, which was a good little adventure. You know, you never know where your career is going to take you, I think is the best thing anybody can learn. And man, what an adventure it was. We had a good class. Again, with all of us being from out of town, we hung out every, you know, really every Thursday we'd all go out as a class as much as we could, because some of us, like, I'd go home and alternate weekends in Columbia because my wife still lived in Columbia. So we'd alternate. She'd come up a weekend. It was really, really cool. Got to know a lot of really good people, some people who've since departed the fire service, that still talk, you know, just really, really good people. You know, some aggravating people too. I can't, you're not gonna lie to you, right? But that was the challenge, right? Is graduating as a team, all of us walking across the stage, and we got to do all kinds of stuff, things I'll never do again, such as palm pier ladders. I've told them, they told me, hey, to stay on this fire department. I'd be like, hey, Danny, can I get a job with you? I'm not staying here, man. Not a favorite of that. We did the 18-inch pipe, which is one of the Charlotte things, and it's more about the mental piece, to get through that. It's a solid 20-minute climb in a plastic pipe with your air pack in front of you wearing turnout gear, and learned a lot about myself in that. Because again, it's, you know, as one of the guys, he's now a battalion chief in Columbia, Thomas Niles, said in our Columbia recruit school, he said, kids got to eat. Every time we did something he hated, he'd quit the water department, come to the fire department. Now he's a battalion chief down there. He always said, kids got to eat. Not that mantra lived in me throughout recruit school. You know, one of the first days, this was before they really held recruits at 5 o'clock. We were there one of the nights. It was, you know, it's known in our department to be a long day. I remember I woke up with a half-eaten Arby's beef and cheddar on my chest, on my couch at my house, to my alarm going off to go to work the next day. And I'm like, oh my God, because I'd gotten home at like 10:30. We'd been doing Denver. We'd done all kinds of difficult, challenging, mentally and physical drills. But man, it's just like anybody who goes to recruit school. The whole goal is to get your badge and patch and walk out the door and have a successful career, right? I think that's the goal. And man, did it. Graduating class 71 and went to 36 with a very senior captain for a couple weeks, which 36, if you know anything about it, is as far from Columbia as you can get. So I was kind of halfway living in Charlotte, half in Columbia. So I moved at the first transfer down to the south side to 26, and was actually stationed with three folks. It was three of us that had graduated recruit school together on the back of Engine 26, and man, what a time. We had four or five young guys, two young captains, one of them who serves as a deputy chief and currently. And man, just what a time learning what the fire department was really about. Jeff McGill, who was he actually passed away from line of duty cancer 5 6 years ago. Jeff was the senior guy trying to keep us all wrangled, so it's kind of funny he rode the ladder. And a lot of competition, a lot of skills learned, a lot of interpersonal skills too. And then man, just continue my career from there. It's been, man, we've got so many things we do within Charlotte. We work in a great city. The city backs us pretty well. You know, we can all complain, right? It's not unicorns and rainbows every day, but frankly, it's one, I think it's the best fire department in the country. Is anybody should have pride in their department. And we got our share of problems, but man, where else? As I told somebody, I was riding Battalion 9 when I first got transferred, and going to a 2-alarm fire that was at this schoolhouse, kind of just on the outskirts uptown. And man, I'm riding through downtown Charlotte, bankers, you know, everything you can think of in a downtown city, looking at the fire trucks going by, and I'm following a tiller as we're swinging through traffic. I was like, man, it's one of those where you smile and pinch yourself, like, is this real that I'm actually like a chief in one of the largest cities in the country, getting to follow a tiller truck? Like, it's like being a kid again. And we all have our days where it's challenging. You know, there's big city stuff that happens. There's small town stuff that happens in every fire department. But in the end, it's a great department, great place. And man, we got some really good things going on. And the cool part, I've gotten to see the growth from this Charlotte Fire Department that was this insular, you know, exclusive place where if you weren't Charlotte, you were nothing, to a very open-minded mindset where we're running mutual aid. We have co-located fire stations with other career departments now. We have mutual aid contracts with just about every surrounding, trying to think, every surrounding career department, with the exception of a couple, and there's some legalese we got to work through on those. But just a big mindset shift to see the growth of the department. You know, tillers, towers, we're getting ready to make some badass engines that'll be coming down the line soon enough. And just to see kind of a renaissance of a lot of the, you know, what's old is new. It's just like, you know, the shoes I'm sitting here wearing, right? The Dunks are cool again, right? They were never cool, now they're cool again. It's just like, you know, we always had tillers, we had some towers, and then we moved away from it, and now we're moving back because functionally they're, you know, those kind of things are important to our organization. So it's cool. I've gotten to get on deployments on USAR. I've gotten to you know, run a high-rise fire. I've gotten to run the big warehouse fire. I've gotten to see a lot of really cool things. You know, within our organization, we get I was talking to a firefighter from Columbia the other day. It's just there's something about some of these departments that throughout our country, right? Everybody gets unique experiences. And you know, I never, again, as I said, Danny, a minute ago, like, you never know where your career is going to take you. Well, my career took me to the airport. And everybody's like, oh my God, the airport. And I mean, even me, I'm like, oh my God, the airport. Worked for a great boss out there and learned more in those 2 years than I'll probably learn ever again in my career, because it was completely foreign. Took it in like a sponge. And man, I got to get on Air Force 2 and see the inside of it. I got to shake the hands of Medal of Honor winners that when we go back to the station, we realize that 40 of them just walked through and shook our hands, and there's only 60 a lot 62 at the time alive. Got to go to Gary Sinise runs a huge thing, and they flew through Charlotte for line of duty desk and military desk. And we went there those 2 weeks. We just happened to be working. And man, I'll never forget, this little girl comes up and she goes, "Mommy, did that fireman know Daddy? Because he's here to see us off to Disney." And man, I about started crying, because I was like, that's what the fire service is about. And it's those moments that I've gotten experience, man. Like, I'd never do that if I was in Battalion 1, Battalion. Each battalion has its own unique experiences, but that battalion was really, if you appreciate it, there's some good opportunities to learn some stuff. You know, you get to talk to cool people, and it was during election season, so it was really busy. But you know, got to meet Secret Service agents from all over the country. Come to find out, a guy I rode the truck with in Columbia is now a Secret Service agent. Just life kind of comes full circle. So I've had a really unique experience. That's you know, kind of one of the strengths of our organization. Just a lot of exposure to a lot of different things that, you know, I again, I get to drive. When I was out in the airport, I'd drive on the airfield, right, following planes down the runway at, you know, whatever miles an hour to catch up to them, and talking to pilots. And you know, when I was out there, had one of the best days I probably ever had in my career. We were doing training, Got interrupted by a two-alarm fire at the airport in the parking garage. Got done with that. Did a spray over where we do the water cannon salute, as they call it, on the pilot side. And the pilot got off the plane and he gave us a real silver challenge coin for his final flight, and just couldn't have been more appreciative. And he had given it to the crew and to the fire crews because we'd been emailing back and forth. And then he bought one for everybody on the flight because it was his final flight after 32 years of being a pilot. Just a really cool day. Like, man, who else gets to do all this? So it's been a really cool journey. And I think something else that important to mention about me, Danny, is also, man, I've volunteered. The minute I got my Firefighter One certification in Columbia, I went over to Lexington County, started volunteering at Oak Grove, volunteered there for 4 or 5 years, moved across the river, ended up getting a job with Charlotte, so didn't volunteer during recruit school. But then again, like I said, when I moved back to Columbia, I was commuting from Columbia to Charlotte and volunteered at Station 27 in Columbia for 5 years. And now I've been with Pleasant Valley and Indian Land, which now are one department, with the Indian Land Fire Department now for 16 years. So I've been a volunteer my entire, as soon as I got my certifications, I've been a volunteer. So I think that's something else I'm proud of. Just because, again, I've gotten to watch a lot of places grow. I've gotten a lot of experience that has helped me in my career side, as well as just helping the community, and run some challenging calls with that. People, one of my kids' friends' houses burned in my neighborhood and I was there helping do CPR on their dog that we had just cared for the week before. So it makes it a little more difficult. But man, what a when I look back, that'll be some of my best times in some ways. So
With that being said, through your experiences and where you are today, did mentorship play a factor in any of this? Because you mentioned Jeff McGill, and I remember seeing the post about him before he passed away, but I'm assuming having a mentor kind of helped guide and mold
no, man, I did it on my own, man. Of course it
you.
did. Yeah, man. I don't want to name mentors too much, but I mentioned Jack McElfish, right? He was the fire chief in Richmond. One of the most valued friendships I ever had. My dad passed away before I even got in the fire service, so he was kind of my de facto dad in some ways. He's the reason I went and got a graduate degree before I got in the fire department. He actually told me in a phone call when I was sitting in my dorm room trying to figure out if I was going to take the what is it, the MAT or the GRE, or if I was going to go to law school, kind of figuring out where I wanted to go in life, right? I knew I wanted to do something in public service. Law school was a path because, again, FBI, ATF, those kind of things, but started talking to people. And he told me, he said, I will do everything I can to make sure you don't get hired until you finish that degree I told you you need to go get. And he said, and after that, I will do everything I can to get you hired. And I was like, okay. And he goes, I'm not saying I know a lot of people, but I know some people. And he did. It's crazy. We'll talk about that in a second. But Jack was a huge mentor of mine. He passed away from cancer last year. Man, I got to go see him in Colorado. It was one of those trips where it's like, I don't want to go because I'm going by myself to see a guy I care about who I know is going to die in the next month. It's one of those trips you're like, I don't want to do this, but I have to. And I just, man, I remember sitting at Red Rocks after I drove. He was staying with his daughter in Steamboat and drove to Red Rocks and just, man, said a prayer to the man and just thanked for the opportunity to for him to mentor me and teach me about how to get to where I am today. He set me a roadmap that is still present today. He taught me how to be a dad. He taught me how to be a good soldier too, right? Like, part of being a firefighter is every now and then you just got to do what the chief or the captain says, and even though you hate it or you think it's dumb, like, you just do it. And he explained that backside because, again, he was a fire chief in three or four departments. Circle back to that, great mentor for me, Thomas Ham. Man, he grew up in some of the worst areas of Richmond. He was African American guy. I mean, in my school, we did not have a lot of diversity. And Ham said, Ham, joked. We joked a lot. He would joke with me about things and how I didn't have much experience with other races, kinds. I went to an all guys school, so picture what that looks like. And man, Thomas taught me a lot about how people grow up differently, but the human race is still the same, if that makes sense. A lot about just, man, people are people, and if you can relate to people, and I got a picture somewhere, and what I may do, I know you put up pictures historically on the Facebook post, maybe I'll get that picture a ham, because we used to go out and have those Freezy Pops out on the front apron of 11. I mean, we'd hear gunshots and I'd be scared to death. And he's like, dude, it ain't nothing. Small arm fire. We're good. I grew up around that. He's like, I grew up down the street. We're good. They ain't gonna mess with firemen. Like, but Thomas Hamm was a huge mentor of mine. Just taught me a lot about my life, right? About, again, about being a dad, about being a good kid, about being successful. Because I mean, Thomas Hamm's a typical fireman, man. If you talk to anybody in Richmond, they would tell you, they would laugh if you said Thomas Hamm. Because Thomas Hamm was in recruit school. He was laying on a bench, took a nap. And I mean, just insert a name in your fire department of this person. He's laying on there taking a nap. Chief of training comes up, says, Hamm, wake up. And he literally looks at him and says, who the is that? And he goes, leave me the F alone. And you can imagine that didn't go well. So Thomas Hamm got sent to Station 11, which was a busy station. So that was punishment. And Hamm stayed there nearly, I think, actually his whole career, and was one of the best. And he grew up in the area. It's kind of a dream story for a fireman, right? Like working in the area that you grew up in. So Thomas Hamm was another one. You know, I've had numerous. I hate to mention too many more because I get in the present day, people would be like, "Oh my God, you forgot this person," but I've worked with some really good people. I've worked with some bad people, and they've kind of been mentors in the other way. But you know, Jack was one. You know, there's some people that I don't want to single out because they'd be mad if I singled them out on a podcast and said, "Hey, this guy," because it's people who would listen to this podcast and they'd be like, "Man, why'd you put me in the spotlight?" But people put me on blast at work, but. I have some confidants that I talk to regularly, particularly in our region. And one of the other benefits is the national piece of, you know, you get to talk to cool people on this podcast. Man, I don't know how often you do it, how you do it, but you get to do it all the time. You get to talk to some really cool people, and I've met some cool people along the way to really steer me and man, to bring you back to zero when you're having a bad day at work and they go, man, this happened at work, and you're like, huh, I think I'm good. And just keeping you in the right mind space, because I think that's a huge piece that firefighters forget. Like a sounding board outside of your organization is so important. Whether it be, you know, because your wife, kid, brothers, whatever, can only listen to so much fire department crap because we are a bunch of kids. And to have somebody to call Danny and be like, hey, man, and you can be like, oh, well, up here, we actually just did the same thing. You're like, oh, okay. So it's not just us. It's not that bad. So I think that's just something to remember. But I mean, I think one of my passions, and Jack really instilled it in me as a young kid, especially as a new father. He was like, man, the most important thing you will ever do in your life is be a dad. The second most important thing is going to be a husband. And those are intertwined together and almost together the most important things you'll ever do. And, you know, I think we all struggle with that. I struggle with it way more than I do now. I feel like my wife might listen to this and be like, oh my God, what is he saying? But, there are times that Jack kept me back to, hey man, it's cool you're teaching. It's cool you're doing all this stuff at work. What are you doing at home? You need to be dumping about 80% into home and 20% at work. And you know, we all got it. I think every young firefighter goes through that because I describe the fire service as a sponge. It just sucks everything out of you if you let it. And put the sponge aside and dedicate a little more time at home. And he was always the one cheerleading me with that, right? Like, hey, what are you doing with your boys this week? Well, you know, and people who follow me on Facebook see that I do some fun stuff. I mean, I just went to New York for 3 days with just me and my kids. My dad passed away, like I said, so I don't get to spend time with my dad. So I want to dump more time into my kids with that. And then we've done that. We did a 2 week, which is a nightmare with a what 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, but we did a 2 week, my wife at home by herself, bored out of her mind, having a great time. And a 2 week trip when my son played in Cooperstown and went to New York, New York State, Gettysburg, DC, went by Richmond. And I just think that's an important outlet too. For me, it is my kids, right? Going to watch soccer and not worrying about what fires are going on. I used to worry about what fires are going on. Just, you know, man, enjoy the soccer game. Be present. Because, you know, now my kids, if you add it up, I think it's 900 and some Saturdays you have with your kid before they go to college. And my son's 14. I got 900. I'm down in the 100 and some range right now, and that's something my mentors have always told me. You know, like you're gonna miss parts of the fire department, but you don't want to miss your kids' lives. And I think that is so important. That was taught to me by so many of my mentors because either they had made that mistake or they watched it. I mean, we're all in the fire service, right? It's probably not a lot of bankers listening to your podcast. Man, how many times have you missed something at work that you got mad? Think about missing the stuff at home. That's when I've started, as my career's continued. I don't miss the fires. I miss the soccer game where my kid scores a goal, or the baseball game where my kid performs well. That's what's important. And man, just dedicate, realizing that most of us work shift, you're working, of those 900 and some or 1,000 and some Saturdays, we're missing 300 of them right off the back end of our shift. So what are you going to do for those 600, right? Or 700? Like, you've got to do that. And that's been taught to me by my mentors, because I think it brings you to work refreshed. I think that, it's important for us to perform at work, but part of that is having an outlet and coming to work with a clean slate in your head and not baggage and stuff. And my mentors help do that. So, and I still don't have it figured out. I don't know that anybody does, but it's nice for somebody to go, "Hey man, what you're doing is cool, but this is cooler." And you go, "You know what? He's probably right." A little self-reflection never hurt anybody. So
That's a fact. That is a fact.
it's,
Self-reflection.
and I mean, it's tough, man, 'cause it, and listening to your stuff, a lot of the people you have on here say the same thing, right? Like, it's tough because you want to be that guy at work. You want to be engaged. You want to be the first one of the truck. And man, we all have bad days, but the more bad day, you're going to have more and more bad days if you're not present at home and you're dealing with issues, because then your kids miss. I mean, I was telling somebody yesterday, I've wanted to, I feel like my son's old enough now that we can actually have like an altercation, like a real altercation, because like he deserves to get hit in the face every now and then. I think every 14-year-old needs it. But he and I joke back and forth all the time. We have a great relationship, but he's the best part of my life has been when his baseball coach and some others have said, "Man, you really raised a good kid." It's much more satisfying than going to the fire station. Man, that Danny that works with you, man, he's a great fireman. That's a compliment. But man, when somebody says that about your kids, more than likely, I bet those same people who are raising the good families, and we all have challenges, but are sitting there at work raising good firefighters, because it's a commonality of leadership. Like, is being a captain is no different than being a dad. I mean, it really isn't, right? I mean, you're wrangling people doing stupid childish stuff half the time, that really we have a serious job in the end. And making that, again, my son's 14. He's making some decisions in his life that could affect the rest of his life at this point. We're not talking about 8-year-old decisions. We're talking about high school decisions that can affect, life, his life. And I think that's no different than some of the decisions you make as a captain on a daily basis. Some of the decisions are, quote, meaningless, but in the end, there's times when decisions you make affect other people's lives. And frankly, when you get down to what we do, it doesn't happen often, but it can affect generations of a family. There are decisions we make, whether it be to search early or not, that can affect a family generationally, right? If we don't do some things we're supposed to do early on, there are people who may pass away that will then not have kids, and it can devastate families. And yeah, most of what we do is, you know what we do on a daily basis. But I think we fail, and I would always say that at the airport, right? The airport, not a lot of calls. You run a lot of alerts where like sensors are bad on aircraft and stuff. But I was like, and we had a lot of young guys, and they're like, "Oh my God, this is boring, the arf, arf, arf." And I'm like, "Hey man, not for nothing. If a plane does lay down, we have to put that stream in the right spot for those 2 minutes, or like hundreds of people die. It's not like an apartment fire where, Danny B sets up the ladder in the wrong spot and we can overcome it." And that mindset just lives with me of that. Like, yeah, we might not do it, but the one time we do, if we don't do it perfect, not only am I going to be sitting at Congress, which happened in San Francisco, right, and explaining why we screwed up, like, people die, and it's not, and we put a stream in the wrong spot, like hundreds of people die. And so that preparation piece has always kind of been one of my things. But I mean, again, it's, I think being present at home can build that, because then when you're at work, you can be at work. You're taken away from your family by being at work, but again, you've given so much when you've been at home by being present. So I think that's just, again, something you asked about mentors. That's something my mentors have taught me, is kind of how to juggle that a little bit. And I'm not perfect by any means at all, even close.
Right. I mean, and no one is, but like you said, that self-reflection, that definitely helps, the process a long way. W when it comes to leadership, so two-part question. How long did you wait to start moving up the ranks, and why?
So, man, I had some experience again in Colombia. I left, went to Charlotte. Had been in the fire department there about a year and a half in operations, 2 years, just about 2 years, between my logistics stint and operations down there. I was able to command a decent amount of fires as a volunteer captain in Columbia, which people don't know a lot about the volunteers in Columbia. Where I was, oh man, we had a lot of fires. And where I lived, I could beat the trucks just about anywhere. Because of where I lived, I could, if I got, you know, it's easier to get in a pickup truck and go than wait on three people to get on the truck. And so unless it was south of the station, but our fire volume was all up my way. So I'd get there, be able to establish command, and then usually hand it off to the career captain. Because again, they knew me because I'd been through their recruit school. You know, I was a little different volunteer because I was one of them that just didn't get paid to be there. I didn't have a huge part-time job, so I'd sit at my house like any young guy. My wife would be at work, and I'd just run calls all day. So I got some good experience with that. Dealt with some personnel issues as a volunteer officer, trying to smooth it over with the career staff at my station. And man, I marginally felt prepared. So in 2010, or I guess it was 2010, I took the captain's test in Charlotte. I was a 5-year captain. I'm the guy everybody hated in Charlotte, and I knew I was going to be okay on some things. What I didn't know is how weak I'd be on the personnel stuff, right? Because we all worry about fires and commanding. So I promoted really early, man, and I don't regret it because what it allowed me to do is then I was a captain 11 years before I promoted to chief. Because you know, and the reason I promoted in 2005, Chief Folk, Lance Folk, you may know him from Breathing Equipment School and some other spots around our area, came in. He was my battalion chief, and he said, "Hey, who's eligible for the captain's test?" And they all looked at me and said, "Well, old Smitty here can." And I was like, "Oh man, I don't know." And he said, "There's going to be 6 spots open July 1st because we're opening Station 40, and so we're going to have 3 relief captains, and there's going to be 3 captains on Engine 40 right off the bat before any retirements." And man, at the time, now we're promoting, I couldn't tell you how many people we promoted to captain last year, but a lot more. And that was a huge opportunity in our department at the time to have 6 plus retirements. I mean, you're looking at possibility of 20 people. In my talking to my captain, he's like, "Man, this hadn't happened in 10 or 12 years where we have this many promotions." I know, I remember there was a guy who was on the captain's list 3 times as the last man standing. And one time he was number one starting in November, and nobody retired after. So he just sat on the list and died until the next year. I was like, "Man, I don't want to be that guy." And so I studied, dedicated myself to it after that, and studied. Never did I think that we'd get our results back. And my captain comes in, he said, "Do you have your class A?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, because I mean, I was like, I failed. I'm going to transfer, get some ladder experience. I'd already talked to captains. Like, I didn't feel good about the test. You know how that goes. What did I do? I finished number 6. So, captain says, "Hey, get your class A on. We're going to the fire chief's office." I was like, "Bro, I just ate breakfast." And Captain Adams is like, "Nope. Chief Fincher just called. You're to be uptown for your meeting before civil service." And I was like, "Today? I just took the test 7 days ago, boss." And went down and had the conversation with Chief Fincher at the time, and got promoted in 2010, and then stayed a captain for 10 or really 11 years. And did that, and that was very intentional, because I knew I was a young captain. I didn't want to be a young chief, because then you're just speeding through the ranks. And I think, having had that, I wish I'd never promoted to chief. I'll be honest, captain is the best position for a leader in the fire department, I think, just because you can affect so much change at such a strong level, because you're controlling the destiny of 4 people, and those 4 people control your destiny just as much. Whereas with the chief, there's a lot more factors. But served with a captain as a captain on Engine 19. I was a relief captain for a few years, Engine 19, then Engine 20, and then I promoted, well, lateral to safety during the best year ever, 2020, and instituted the shift safety officer position that I'd kind of been a advocate for through my work with the union and stuff. But that was important to me, man, to have that 11 years as a captain, because man, as a chief, there's not a, and I think Chief Farnum said it on your podcast, and I was actually talking to him the other day about what he said. By the time a question gets to the chief, most of the easy answers are gone, particularly at Chief Farnum's level, right? A division chief, like, all the easy answers are done at that point. But as a chief, like a battalion chief, that first level of chief, most of the easy answers are gone. And you got to have some institutional knowledge, some pulse on the organization, some paperwork, some incident. You got to have a lot. You got to be kind of versatile. Because if a captain calls you with a problem, most I know in my battalion now, my captains are not calling me unless they don't know what to do. They're not going to call me and be like, "Hey, chief, we're going to training today. What do I need to do?" They're going to be like, "Hey, we're riding short," because they're going to make a decision and tell me about it. They're not going to ask me to make the decision. And I think that's one of the reasons I stayed a captain so long, was to have that depth of knowledge. And that was advice given by mentors, as well as just me observing, taking a pulse of where I could be. And I think, one of the cha I'm the guy that every fireman hates. You know why, Danny? Because I didn't know how to use a chainsaw till I got in the fire department. I have a master's degree. Put that in a fire station and tell me what the impression of Jonah was when I walked in the doors. But one thing that I knew is I didn't know some stuff, and I took pride in trying to seek out people who knew stuff. John Newman, he was in my recruit class. He worked in the Inyo National Forest with the National Park Service, or with the Federal Fire Service, on a hand crew. And he could take a chainsaw apart and put it back together. And he and I would do it during recruit class, because I had no idea what I was doing. So he showed me, and I found those people. I've worked with some very, I've learned things like that I never thought I'd learn how to do at the firehouse. But it's because you got to show some humility and humbleness to go, "Hey, I don't know what I'm doing. Can you show me?" And I think that's where we fail in today's fire services. We're like, "Oh, you new guys don't know." Well, dude, I can't help. I grew up in downtown Richmond, and my dad was a doctor. We had two trees, and guess what? He paid people to come cut the tree down when we cut it down in our backyard. I'm sorry I didn't work on a farm, man. Like, that makes you no better or no worse than me. And so, I did that. Knew I had a lot to learn as a captain. Went that route, and man, I would not trade those years in captain for anything. I'd laugh with from our fire chief to the newest firefighter. I said, "Man, I screwed up when I got promoted to chief." There's a lot of influence and conversations that I get to be in being a battalion chief. But man, the years of being a captain, just so much fun, so fulfilling, so frustrating. Just all about it was just a really good time. And again, it was because I knew I needed to learn the craft at a captain level. And then, man, we were, I was in safety. A lot of retirements were coming up, and so I said, "Man, I'm going to promote to chief," because I did see some people, just like anybody, that I was like, "Man, I don't know that I really want to be under them." And our organization's growing, so there's turnover here and there, and it's like, "You know what? I'm going to try it out." Well, got finished, what, sixth on the list again, ironically. They promoted five, and then Chief Newman up and retired in December. No idea I was getting promoted. I already had come to terms with, you know what, I might not even take the test next year. I'm just going to stay in safety and learn some stuff, get some more certifications, for the future life, because there's a lot of stuff in safety you can do. And man, got the call from one of the deputies, said, "Hey, you're getting promoted effective 2 weeks after the other guys." I said, "Okay." And made chief. And man, again, what an experience in our department. Relief chief in school, you get to see all the battalions, you get to meet people, see people I hadn't seen in years, and landed at Battalion 8. And man, then was wanting to go downtown, kind of got bumped out by some seniority while I was out there. Man, they opened new Battalion 9. I was like, how cool will it be in my career to have opened safety and then open a new battalion? You don't get those opportunities every day in any size of organization. And I think it makes my experience unique, right? Like, being the first shift safety officer on C shift and having to interface and figure out what we were going to do on fires, and being Battalion 9 and creating a what I want to create is a culture, and but not changing the culture, falling into their culture and adapting it to what I believe. And again, working with, I mean, if you know anything about what Charlotte, like, Battalion 9 is it's where it's at. A lot of there are a lot of good battalions in the city, but Battalion 9, there's not a the slowest company is Station 7, and I think last year they ran 3,200 calls because of 11's relocation. But I've got the busiest engine in the city, one of the top five busiest engines. Every day, about three or four companies in the battalion are in the busiest in the city. So really cool. And you can rush through promotions, but I value my time, especially as a company officer, man. I almost wish I'd been a fireman a little longer, because then it's just whatever every day. But as a captain, I just I, when I when I when my days are done, those will be my some of my fondest memories, because I lifelong friends, energizing people who weren't necessarily energized. I didn't work with all type A, pipe hitting firefighters. But all those guys became that because they saw my pride in it. And then they had that pride in them, which then pushed me even further. And a lot of them know that, because I've had that conversation of like, "Hey, man, like, you helped me be better." And they're like, no, you didn't. No, man, I'm telling you, like watching your eyes light up when we do something on a fire that we talked about, like that's my crack, right? That's my addiction, is to see that. So
Wouldn't you say though, with you now being a battalion chief, because you mentioned company officer to you is the best position in the fire service, but with you being a battalion chief and overseeing more personnel, don't you feel like you have a greater reach because it's like you're the battalion chief for Battalion 9, and what do you have, like 4 or 5 stations you command
yeah,
or under?
it's 10 captains.
10 captains.
Yeah, so two release captains and then eight captains on trucks
I would
or
feel
engines.
like, I would feel like, wouldn't your reach be even greater now? Because it's like, hey, if you come to Battalion 9 under me, these are the standards, these are the expectations we're gonna have every day. Whereas
I think
with
you
the
do.
company officer, it's just one specific truck.
Yeah, but at company officer, I think you can affect more change than people give it credit, particularly in smaller organizations, right? If I'm a captain and I'm energized and my chief lets me run, which is to your point, Danny, right? But I think that captains don't understand they can actually impact the stations around them. Because that happened with me. I was impacted by, there was a captain when I was at 20, he was big into ropes, and I'm not into ropes. But my guys float to that truck. We got to do ropes. And he was so good at doing that he impacted me to take a little pride in getting my folks to learn, and there's that bleed over. But you are right. I mean, as a chief, you have the impact. But man, and I go back to something, and it's funny, people who are your he now works with me, one of my captains. We had a pretty significant disagreement at one point. We were captains, and man, we're friends, and he works with me, and I guess for me, I don't like saying for me, but works with me now. And we've talked about it, like in the fire station should never be the most stressful part of the fire department, because we control that, right? Like we control the attitude in those four walls. And as a chief, I can control some of that within those four walls because I'm responsible for it. I'm the landlord, as I tell everybody. But so I can make it hell. Like, hey, when I come in, the damn, this better be done, this better be done, this better be done. Or I can be like, hey, I'm gonna stop by every now and then just make sure everything's going good. There's two different narratives. And when you give the captain's freedom, and you set some expectations. And it's to Jared Sergi's point. You know, he's a good friend of mine. I saw that post yesterday, and it's the same thing we talk about when we're hanging out or talking. That, man, just every now and then you just got to let the company officer make the mistake or make the right call. Because you never know what the right call is until you know what the wrong one was. And sometimes in our job, man, I need you to make a call. We can talk about what was right, wrong, what we can do better, but I need decisive decision making. And I feel like as a chief, one of the benefits you do have, right, is the ability to set the tone within your battalion. And with that said, giving the freedom to the people who need it, right? The people who need a little more guidance, it's a selective supervision, but you don't let them know that, right? You work with them, you stay more in contact with them, because you've always got the captain. And it's like I say in some of my stuff I've taught before, you got the captain who's like needs the, hey man, you're doing great. I love you so much. Thank you. And then you've got another captain who's like, hey man, you didn't suck today. Thank you. And you gotta have a relationship to understand that. And I just go back to some of the chiefs I worked with, man. There were some chiefs who'd come around all the time, and they'd always be up the captain's rear about whatever it was. And then there were chiefs who would stop by, deliver significant messages, check in, have a cup of coffee, just. Because in the grand scheme of things, and Chief Barbara Beam, another one who passed away from cancer, she was my chief, and I will still say, much to the dismay of one of the other chiefs I worked with, because he says he was the best, but she was one of the best I've ever worked for. Just let you do your job. Once she trusted you with everything she had, and she would let you do your stuff. And she also would take criticism, because she came into fire station one day, and I said, hey, this is our house. You are the boss. You're the landlord, but like you need to understand, like fire stations have fire station stuff that happens, and I don't need the chief just waltzing in. And she never came in that station again without ringing the doorbell unless the doors were open. That was her rule, and that's my rule. I ring the door because I'm coming to your house. Like I'm a house guest. I don't belong there. I'm not one of those chiefs that comes and hangs out all day just because. Like right now, we're temporarily located by ourselves at our safety office, ironically. Because Station 11's being renovated. And so I eat dinner sometimes at a fire station. Sometimes I go to Optimus Hall up there in NoDa and eat and just sightsee and whatever. And some of the chiefs are like, man, I'd go hang at a fire station. I'm like, I don't, because it's not my house. Like, my house is here. This is where I'm at. And I think that's a huge piece of being a chief is just that impact you can have on the freedom, because it goes back to, and Dave Rhodes has done a really good job putting it out on the forefront, with his platform, right? Is that poor leadership has a greater impact on somebody's mental health than anything. So if I'm always on somebody, man, they're going to start feeling like the chiefs, they're not going to reach out to me for other things. They're not going to ask for help because they're going to be like, chief, don't listen to me. And then you're not approachable. And then it leads into a not feeling of belonging. And, you know, then it goes from not feeling like you belong to, I'm just not going to do my job because I don't belong here anyway. They don't care about me. I'm just a number. All the things that we all hear in the firehouse. And so I do feel like, to your point, that is one of the benefits of being a chief is, and I hate it because it's something chiefs who don't necessarily want to get promoted, that get promoted say, but it's 100% true. If not me, who's going to be in that conversation with the deputy chiefs or the division chiefs to defend some firemanship if I'm not in it? And it's not about Jonah. It's about there's quite a few of us in Charlotte who are dedicated to the craft. If those people aren't in the conversation, somebody's going to be in that conversation. Like, somebody's going to be there. Who is that going to be? We need more people like that. And that's a tough pill to swallow because it truly is kind of service above self in some ways, right? Like, you as a chief that is into the craft and would rather be a company officer, maybe we still need chiefs who are good company officers, who are dedicated to craft, who understand, you know, vertical. We're not just checkboxing off John Norman's book or Anthony Castro's book, like that we've actually got to understand why we're making operations and then have credit. But I think the hardest part of being a chief is the relationship you have to have, where you got to have the tough conversations like, hey, Danny, you're screwing up, man, and it's not okay. And I set these expectations, but hey, man, let's go get a cup of coffee across the hall. Like, that piece is very difficult for a lot of people because it's a difficult, uncomfortable conversation. And I've grown in that because, man, I did not want to get on anybody's rear as a chief. Like, just, you know, oh, no, you can't see me on the podcast, but like, cover my eyes going, oh, I didn't see that. There's, you know, the plausible deniability is funny, right? Because there's a lot of things that happen at a fire station. Like, I'm going to be in my office. I don't know what's going on out there. It's really loud and it sounds like water and I'm in here. But there's times when you as a chief see something, and if you don't correct the behavior, all it does is create that environment where then the captain doesn't correct. And those
Boom.
little things turn into death by a thousand cuts, man. And it's tough. But my understanding from my mentors and you know, the Jared Sergis and the other people you've had on this podcast before that I lean on is, and every now and then, like, even my friends, we have tough conversations, right? My kids, like, hey, man, this is not okay. But then guess what? We're going to go to a baseball game together. Like, that's why I say being a dad is one of the, because then you gain those skills, because I have, of, man, looking a 14-year-old in the face and say, hey, what you're doing is not okay. And this is why, but hey, let's sit down and have dinner. And maybe he gets a, you know, gets a pouty face and he's mad at you. But man, first I've got a job to do. And if you make me do my job, then it's more challenging for me. But you know what? And that's why I laugh. Like, that's why a lot of chiefs do spend time by themselves or calling people. Because guess what? Every now and then you got a vent. And you can't go to the fire station and be like, man, that freaking Danny B over at Station One's a damn idiot. He drove me nuts today. Like, you can't do that. Some do, but you can't. The key is to then, you know, have that outlet again and ways to move on. Because one thing, and Kyle said it in the podcast the other day, man, so well. And he and I've known Kyle, as I told you before we started, for a long time, really since he started getting his name out teaching and stuff. And to hear some of the things he said is refreshing, because it was the same thing. I remember our former deputy chief, I was in the union, was making some bad decisions with my attitude, I would say, in the department. I was not respected. I was just a loudmouth 9, 10 year guy. And I was the guy with the backpack and napalm. Man, if it wasn't for me, I'd scorch earth policy. Bam, done. And guess what? Oh, I don't care about that bridge. I'll burn it. I didn't need it. And then you then and Chief Jones caught me at the front desk of headquarters, and I tell numerous people the story and said, Jonah, you're not always wrong, but what is wrong is your message. So nobody listens to what you're right about because of your message and the way you deal with people. And I could have just gotten in the brush truck and gone back to 20 and been like, oh man, whatever, he's just an admin guy. But I did some self-reflection and said, wait a second, he's completely right. And I said, man, I'm gonna have to change, and I've been on a it's just still a journey, because I'm not scared to say what I think, but it's a different message, right? It's respectful, it's professional, and I think that's where a lot of people miss the boat is let's get to the core of the problem, talk about the problem, and then try and solve the problem or figure out we can't fix the problem and move on, man. Like let's have a good day at the fire station, because that fire station, if it's the most stressful thing, what about the calls we run? Now, we don't run a ton of stressful calls, but for when we do, man, like I need you to be on your game. I don't need you to be pissed off because I yelled at you about the trash getting emptied. Like these are things, and I laughed with even some people I've talked to recently, is I think it's completely unacceptable how poorly we treat each other around the firehouse and then expect everybody to be a team. Like B shift sucks because they didn't empty the trash. Dude, who cares? Were you going to empty the trash? Well, that's my job. Yeah, so shut up, man. It's more fulfilling because it's full. It's full. So now, hey, man, it's worth your time. Well, B shift suck. I don't care about B shift, dude. I don't care what my neighbor does with their kids. You know, they're not my kids. I care about my kids, my people, those things. And the more we focus on our, and it was Steve Kraft, who is a chief somewhere in up in Canada. And I went to FDIC. And we talked, or he talked, he did his keynote up there, and it was about fixing yourself before you try and fix everything else. And that was around the same time when I had that conversation with one of the deputies, and I was like, man, I feel like God is literally telling me you're an idiot. And I learned a lot from that. Again, self-reflection, some discussion with mentors and their difficulties. Like, dude, the fire station is the fire station, and the firehouse is the firehouse, and then work is work. It's still a workplace, but you know what? In the end, we get to have a pretty cool time while we're there. So,
A lot of facts, a lot of no lies told being stated. I'm gonna go back to one of the things you said is correcting the problem before it gets bigger. And through my experiences and talking to many different individuals, that seems to be a problem for high performers or individuals who hold higher standards in their departments is we see the problem. The organization knows the problem, but chooses to do nothing about it. And then when they don't do anything about it, nothing gets done. It's a trickle effect. If the chief of the organization knows about it, doesn't do anything, battalion chief sees it, captain sees it. It's just a vicious cycle. And that's, in short, it's a direct reflection of the organization's culture too. You know, like if nobody gives a damn, then okay, whatever. Like nobody cares.
Well, and man, it goes back to and you're from our area, so it's not any foreign facts. Chief Johnson, since he arrived in Charlotte, has been huge on safety vests, right? A fluorescent safety vest. And that's been one of his things that he has struggled with our department on. And I having worked at the airport, I have an even better perspective than just the discussion we have in safety. I'm like, how hard is it to put on a safety vest? Like, well, man, this is be Dude, if it's his thing, he is the boss. And he, like, there's other things that he wants, but, like, dude, if that's his thing, just do it. Like, I don't have time to. Man, I can get great, like, well, our drivers to wear a coat and helmet and gloves when they throw ladders. And, man, you wouldn't believe the backlash. It's like, hey, you do realize, like, what if somebody pops out the window you're throwing a ladder to? You're going to engage. He is trying to make sure you're protected when you engage instead of going up there and cutting your arm off, trying to get the person out because we know what we're going to do, right? Well, I don't have time to do that. Okay, man, there's very few times when you don't have time, but if you need help getting dressed out of the back of a car, I'll come put on a clinic for you. Like, 'cause I've learned it, right? Like, when I was in safety, I was getting dressed out of the back of a car and I would beat people to the fire ground sometimes. Like, how the hell did you get dressed so fast? 'Cause I have to, dude. Like, the little things like that that people just, dude, go, I tell you what, go to the ramp at Charlotte Douglas International Airport and walk around as a baggage guy. The dude who's loading your baggage in the thing and don't wear a safety vest. See what happens. See what the guy that's wearing a safety vest that says manager on the back is going to tell you, hey man, Air Ops just stopped by. It's a $100 fine to you. He's going to write you a ticket. You just lost your badge, which means you don't get paid for a couple of days. You're suspended for 7 days by the airport, not even by American. And then, man, come back next week. If you do it again, guess what? You won't need the safety vest. And if you do, it's because you're standing in the street at the unemployment line. And too many people in the fire department forget, like, it is the firehouse, dude. I 100% get it. But By definition, in all the cities, municipalities, organizations we work for, if you're getting compensated, and even if you're not as a volunteer, it is a workplace. And there are rules of a workplace that I bet you go up to the Bank of America Tower right now. There's some rules those people don't like, but guess what? They follow. And it's not about being a good soldier and yes, sir, I'm gonna do whatever you say, sir. It's critical thinking, discussing, hey, it's not just you wear the safety vest, because that is, it's so trivial to me that people get so upset about it. But go to a fire department anyway. I mean, you know, like go to a fire department and tell me that it's not, that's not just an R issue. That's, but it's so trivial when we literally responsible for possibly saving someone's life that we're arguing about safety equipment. And we're not talking about something that's like, you got to put on a night suit, you know, that you got to shingle around it. Like it's literally same as putting your shirt on, except faster. And number two, it's so that if something bad happens, then we can get your family taken care of. If so, even if something bad doesn't happen, how many times do you think you've been sitting on the interstate or a road where somebody's seen that orange vest or yellow vest and hasn't hit you? We can't quantify it, but I promise you, there was a guy I was driving home from teaching the other night, and if he hadn't been wearing a safety vest because he'd gotten off work from construction, I would have hit him because I wouldn't have seen him. He doesn't know that. He just thinks he walked across the road and the car slowed down. We've got to think about those things, because in the corner office where the chief's making some of these decisions in a vacuum, you got to have people in that conversation, like we talked about, to give some reasoning with some stuff. But man, if the fire chief doesn't care about this and that, and it's not all about, you know, I'm not a firm believer, if you can't wear the right color socks, you're not a great fireman. Like I'm not down with all that. But at the same point, the captain that looks past all, you know, the totality of things is a problem, because then the chief has to deal with it. Now, what is Jonah doing? Now, Jonah, the battalion chief, he's the bad guy because I came in and fixed the problem instead of the captain being the bad guy and being able to have that conversation in the station, right? Hey, Danny, you're not meeting expectations. This is what's going on. Instead, the chief comes in. I got to come in hard because I'm a chief, right? So I'm the next level of supervision, because if I don't deal with it, then I'm going to get in trouble. And then I walk away. So there's no context to our conversation as much as you can have with a captain. And that context of conversation, if I say, hey, Danny, you're an idiot right now, you're like, ha ha. But if I like say it with no context, you're like, that chief just called me an idiot. And it's all about context of conversations. When the chief comes in and comes down on somebody and then leaves, that context is lost. Whereas the captain has all the pieces of the puzzle. They're watching the behavior every day, whatever's going on, and control that. Like, hey, I might walk in and see somebody completely out of uniform and have to say something, right? But what if the captain was like, hey, he just got in because his wife was at work and he had to take his kids to school? I don't know that context, man. But I come in and I come hot. That's where it's so difficult as a chief, because you lose the context because you're removed from a lot of the situations. And I think it's important for people to understand that that is one of the most difficult things. Because again, when it comes to if you say, hey, this is going on in my firehouse, I don't have usually but two or three answers. And when it goes above my head, there's usually one. And if it goes past them, there might not be an answer you're really excited about. And you get mad when the fire chief says, I got to do this. Well, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. You took it all the way to the corner office. That's not the route it should have been done. If the captain fix it, document it. Well, we can't get rid of this guy, or we can't do this. Okay, let me see your documentation. And they hold a post-it note up with, I don't like Danny. He's mean. You know what I mean? Like, we got to have some actual, and man, I was laughing with, I forget, I think it was our chief of training the other day. We were talking, and he said, man, we're doing chief officer development. We're doing scenarios. I said, hey man, I'll be honest, we can get through the fires. Let's train our chiefs in personnel problems, because I can tell you the fires are way less challenging. You hear that from chiefs, but like, hey chief, I've got somebody who's claiming harassment down here. Like, I'd rather command the Liberty Row fire than deal with that. Cause it's like, all right, hold on, let me go get my policy book, read it, look at the city policy book, call my proper people, get yelled at by those people. Like, what the hell's going on? I don't know, man. I got to go down there. Well, hurry up. I can't, because I don't know what I'm doing. You know? So I think that that's inherently in the fire service, as in any job site, because we try to insulate ourselves from it. We're another job. We are. It's a cool job. And we have a great function, and it's unique, but it's still a workplace. And any workplace where small problems aren't dealt with, there's problems at higher levels every time. And talk to any chief in any department and tell me the guy that got fired, there's very few, the guy who got fired, the big lawsuit, the whatever, that were dealt with at the smallest level and followed up to the point where where it terminated, there's very few of those that just showed up. Like all of a sudden, Danny has a problem or Jonah has a problem. It's historic. And it goes back to what I said about company officer, having that relationship to know when something's going on with somebody to prevent, hey, man, why are you late for work today? Oh, man, okay. Happens again. Like, oh, man, blah, 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 blah. No, what else is going, like, hey, man, are you good? Yeah, man, me and my wife. Okay, let's talk, man. What can I do to assist you? Because I think we default when context is lost by, say, my rank in our organization. When context is lost, somebody's late, I got to deal with it. But you as a captain can deal with it at a different level because now you go, hey, he's late. We got to document this. We got to do this. But it's also because we got this going on. I'm going to work with them on some things. And you give people the benefit of the doubt, but you still document and you do what you got to do. Because then it lets them know this is still a workplace, but that we're there for them. The problem is we think there's a dichotomy there, to use a big word, right? We think there's a fork in the road where I got to be with the men or against the men. And there's not. Like, you got to do some of both, particularly as a captain, because if you don't start dealing with it early head on, it's not going to get any better. Because people do people things. Life happens to people. People have problems. We all got problems, right? And just think about, and I think back to Bobby Halton. I didn't mention him as a mentor. A lot of people think a lot of different things about Bobby Halton. And I was going through a very difficult period of my life. Just failing as a dad in some way. Young kid, man, I'm tired all the time. I'm working all the time. I'm working at a busy company. Got a lot going on. I was starting to teach and travel and eating that up. And man, I was just, and had some events happen at work that were really, some of my best friends were telling me I was screwing up. And I was in a really, really, when I say really, really bad spot, it's in a really bad spot. And some things have been said to me, very hurtful by people I cared about. And I was like, man. And Chief Halton heard about it through a friend of a friend, and he called me and we talked for an hour. And I will never forget that conversation, how much he cared, the advice he gave me. It showed me a different side of what some people thought he was. But what it offered me was an opportunity to realize, hey, man, I'm glad he called me out and helped me, and some other people are helping me through this, because this ends way different if that phone call doesn't happen. This ends in a way worse story if someone doesn't reach out to me and say, hey, dude, I know you're not good, so don't tell me you are. And you go, okay, let's have this conversation. Like, let's talk about what's going on with me to fix me, not, hey, man, you good? Because it's very easy to say, yeah, and walk off and not be good at all. It's very hard when somebody says, you are not good, and I need to talk to you, to walk away and say, no, bro, I'm good. Because that defensive posture is harder to defend when you're struggling. Because I think anybody, and I think every firefighter, just in the nature of our work, not just the calls, just everything, the holistic picture of the fire service, has those issues. And I think one of the challenges that we face with that is that we always chalk it up to the calls. Like, it's not always about the calls. It's about what's going on at home and what you're missing, and that juggling act that we all play when you have kids or you're trying to date somebody or whatever is going on, man. But in the end, that caring for somebody, you're not going to know without that relationship. And if you don't know what's going on with your people, and it's very difficult as a chief, that's one of the things I do miss, is it's very difficult to know what's going on with all my officers, and then let alone all the firefighters. But I've had a discussion, since I made chief, in my old battalion, guy was going through a very similar issue to something me and my wife had happened. His captain reached out to me, hey, man, he's got this going on. You may see him out sick. Good. I'm good, man, because that's one of my expectations. If one of your people have got something going on, let me know so I don't come down on them. And he was like, hey, he's having this. I said, do you mind if I reach out to him? Because that's not my job. That's the captain's job. But I said, hey, we have similar life experience. And I called him, and he about started crying when I came into fire station the next time. He said, hey, can I talk to you in the back parking lot? I said, yeah. And I'm like, oh, God, he's going to say, like, what you said, you're wrong, whatever. And he goes, I just want to let you know, like, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I was like, dude, I wish somebody had similar experience when I was going through this, because it made it harder to not have anyone to relate to. I know where you're at. If you got to go home sick right now because your wife called you because of what y'all got going on, go. Go. I don't care. We'll work out the rest of it. You'll be charged time. I can't give you time, but you're not going to hear anything from me. And if my boss comes to me about it, he's going to get a very clear it's handled. And if he doesn't like that answer, then we're going to have a very aggressive discussion because that's not his problem. It's my problem. And it's really your captain's problem. And I think that's a huge piece to, because I think that's part of it, man. People struggle to relate to one another at times because of just dissimilar lives. And man, common ground's everywhere. You know, common ground there. Like I said earlier, one of the things that Ham taught me in Richmond was, man, the human race is the human race. Like, everybody's got problems. Some people, there's good people and bad people, all the things. But, and I say this kind of to Kyle's point and something we talked about before. When people come to work at the fire department, they don't want to suck. Some people do suck, no doubt, right? But nobody's like, man, I can't. There's two things nobody comes to work riding in their car, you know, driving up 77 or wherever they go, and they don't pull up to the fire station and throw it in park and go, man, I can't wait to listen to Jonah complain all day. They don't want to hear your crap. That's number one. Number two is nobody throws it in park and goes, man, I hope I suck at my job today. Some people do, but nobody wants to. And so when you get that sense of belonging, these relationships I'm talking about, that common ground somewhere, then you can push that person. As I always say, if they're a 30, you're going to have 100, you know, people who rate 100 out of 100. You're going to have people who rate 20 out of 100. Some of those 20s we can turn into hundreds. Some of those 20s, man, they may always be a 20, but we got to keep them at a 20. We got to keep them at a 21. We got to push them as hard as we can get them, because when that roof falls, it might fall on your 100. And now you're dependent on you and the 20 to get them out. And if they don't have a damn clue because you wrote them off, you've done a disservice to your best person. Because, you know, I love sports, any team sports you got out there. Like, man, if you got a weak right fielder in baseball, that don't mean that they just go, well, we're just going to take him out of the game and put him on the bench. We'll just play with two outfielders. No, he's still part of the team. And we struggle with that in the fire service. And then Kyle put it, I'm telling you, I loved it when he said, we're not Navy SEALs. Some people are high performers, right? Just like in the Navy, there's Navy SEALs, and then there's folks who are in the Navy, and then there's like high performers at other spots. We have that same piece. We got to remember, like, not everybody's going to be the dude who's going to conferences and taking all these classes and learn all these things. He may be with his kids all week because they're traveling to here and there and just doesn't have time. But when he's at work, he's at work. I can control work. When you're at work, I need you at work. And man, if you got some other stuff to do, that's cool. Guess what? Give me the morning. Like I said, I had a chief come up to me. Hey, I see you're out here changing brakes at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was like, chief, do you know we pulled 800 feet of hose this morning? Then we threw 500 feet of ground ladders, and then we turned around and we did water supply drills to work on our changeover for our new guy, and we did a pre-plan, and we still cooked lunch. And I said, what did the other station do that you're at? He goes, well, man, they didn't do that. So don't come up here barking out orders that at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we're in the back parking lot. I get it. Nobody can see us. And you know what? I can justify that to the fire chief if he wants. And guess what else it is? When you're changing brakes and messing around the fire station, guess what happens? There's a lot of bonding that happens that we can't put a price on too. Because now everybody makes fun of me because I'm an idiot when it comes to stuff like that. And it just becomes fun to make fun of each other because that's what we do. So,
No,
but.
it's all facts. Like, my biggest thing is, like you said, finding that common ground for, especially when for chief officers, like finding that common ground, understanding how it was. Maybe it was a different time when they were growing up in the fire service, but building that team trust, that camaraderie. But also another big piece, I think, is your high performers, and we all. Every organization has them. You have your 20s or your 30s, like you said, or your high performers. But recognize your high performers. You know, don't just put the 20 or 30 scoring person with that high performer. Like, they're not on the same level playing field. So, like, acknowledge that. Kind of everybody wants an attaboy. Like, I don't know one person that doesn't like hearing an attaboy. Like, it's just being able to build that relationship and that trust. And I think that's where a lot of chief officers fall short, or they essentially forget what it's like being one of the boots on the ground. But I loved your whole take on it.
I just think it's important for people to remember that everybody is a man or woman first, and everybody should be treated as such. And then we go from there. What kind of employee are they? Firefighter? Because, and I think it was Will Jackson. And I don't know if you've had, if you don't ha haven't had him, he's a great dude from down on the eastern part of our state, doing really good work as a ch young, very young chief officer down there. But his take on some things a couple months back was, you know, like, I don't care if you're a great firefighter, if you're an awful employee. We run fires, but man, like, that doesn't give you an excuse for the other 22 hours of the day to just be a pain in my rear end. Like, I need you to be a little of both. I need you to be a good firefighter. And I was having a discussion with chief at one of our peripheral departments, Charlotte. I said, man, I'd rather have a marginal employee who's a great firefighter than an awful employee who's a great firefighter. But I'd also rather have a marginal firefighter that I can train who's an excellent employee, because then I can teach you a lot about how to be a firefighter. Not just me. We can get you where you need to go. But that employee who's impressionable, that is an excellent employee, is more of an asset to the organization than somebody who's, man, when they put a nozzle in their hand, they're majestic, but around the fire station, they're a nightmare. Like, we all have those folks too, and that's part of the fire service. But man, sometimes it's like they're just intolerable around people, which is literally 90% of our job is being around people and not in a mask just with a nozzle in our hand, right? Most of it is dealing with medical calls, fire alarms, dealing with the public. Like, when the person resets the fire alarm, that the captain doesn't go, "Hey, you freaking idiot, don't reset that." Hey, man, but that captain's a great captain. No, man, like, he's not. Part of being a captain is that piece. Like, it's just because he's majestic of commanding the fire ground or training people, just because he treats everybody he doesn't like crap does not give him, that's not, nowhere in my HR manual does it say, "Oh yeah, that's okay. Jonah can talk to people like that because Jonah's really good at this." No, man, it doesn't say that. Like, again, I think the fire department, and again, this is everybody that listens to me, like, "Oh, that's a typical chief take." It's still a workplace, man. Like, you go to some of these other workplaces and do some of the stuff that we do at the fire station. I'm not just talking about the jokes, from the way we talk on Facebook to each other in our own departments. Like, what are we doing? You want, and, like, the brotherhood's dead. Yeah, that's because I don't put anything on Facebook, because I don't want to. I'm just going to get mad about people that I shouldn't even care about. You know what I mean? And I think that I think that's a huge piece of the world, right? You got to treat people the way you want to be treated. It's basic, but so many people forget that because they're like, "Well, I don't treat him well because he's an idiot." Okay, man, I get it. It's frustrating, but there is a thing that emotional intelligence is an actual thing you must do, right? Like, controlling your emotions is part of being a firefighter, because there's so much around the kitchen table that can turn into an emotional argument. And if you don't control it and maintain professionalism, Dr. Seuss, one of my favorite quotes I use every now and then, "Behave today as is the day you will be remembered." Think about that in the firehouse, man. When you walk in, there are words I can say in a firehouse that would alienate thousands, millions of people, cost me my job. There are words I can say at the dinner table that, unfortunately, I have heard and either corrected, or when I was younger was like, "Oh God." There are things you can say about people, to people, whatever, in the firehouse, or behavior you can exhibit that will alienate people who may need you as a mentor forever. Forever. You can say, "Well, I mean, just remain marginally less controversial, but you can say them damn Democrats are a bunch of idiots." Well, what if that guy that's sitting at the kitchen table is of that political persuasion? They're not going to listen to you, man. And you may have the best knowledge of being an engine or a truckman in the whole wide world. You might be Mike Ciampo, but you say that, you've turned that guy off. And now he's a less of a great firefighter because you turned him off. And it's really your fault. It's not that, "Oh, well, softies, dude, half the stuff we used to do in the fire department was not okay anymore." I mean, tying somebody up and putting them in a flagpole while marginally funny is actually called assault. It's always been a crime, right? And some of the things we do have always been wrong. But like, "Oh, we're getting soft around here." Hey, man, pump the brakes for a minute. Like, stripping somebody's clothes off when they don't want them, or whatever your department's done, right? Painting people, that there are parts of things we've done that have always been criminal, that like, finally somebody was like, "Hey, man, that's enough." And like, "Oh my God, Jonah's getting soft." Like, bro, these things cause me to lose my job. My kids got to eat dinner. So I think, again, I think that's just something we got to remember, that in a workplace, there's an inherent respect that should be there. It's just more difficult in our job. No different than in the military in some ways, right? I don't like the paramilitary thing, because, like, in the fire service, you're like, "Oh, chief, I don't like what I'm doing." You say that in the military in the heat of battle, they're not going to be like, "Oh yeah, I think you're right." So there's elements of that that I don't agree with, but we live with each other, right? We live with each other. That inherently brings more drama, difficulty, difficult conversations, differences, but it also brings, to me, it brings a better bonding too, and job fulfillment in a lot of ways. I mean, learning how people father their kids, learning how to cook, learning how to do stuff that I never knew how to do. Learning what, just whatever, man. The things that happen at a fire station that are positive, there's so many positives that outweigh those negatives. Don't let the negatives take it over, right? And one of our captains put it best years ago. He said, "I don't give a crap if the chiefs are up there in pink tutus throwing monkey crap at each other. I'm here at ladder one, and I'm gonna have a good day. That's all I'm worried about. I don't care what's going on up there. They don't control my firehouse." There are parts that bleed over, and in smaller departments, a little different. But in our department, we have pretty good autonomy. Like, don't let that sour your day. Because no, again, nobody threw it in park and was like, "Man, I can't wait to Jonah listen to Jonah bitch all day." Like, do people? Some people come to the fire station to take a break from their personal lives, their other professional life. You know, like, "Hey, I just want to come in and have the captain tell me what to do today." Right. And I think a lot of chiefs, it's funny having these discussions with other chiefs. Like, when I retire, I want to have a job where, "Hey, Danny, you're going to tell me what to do today." "Oh, Chief Smith, no, I don't know anything. You tell me what to do. I don't want to make a decision today." And I think we forget about that. And again, that's the captain's, "I shouldn't have to develop these new guys." Oh, so that would be called, let me think of the word. Oh, entitlement that you're saying that person has. So you're entitled to do what you want to do on a daily basis. The very definition of entitlement. So, I caution people, particularly the older guys, who are like, "Well, these new kids are entitled." By you saying that, in some way, with your behavior, you're acting entitled as well. "I should be able to see, they should come into my firehouse ready to go." That is what entitlement is. Look it up. And
Excellent.
this job is not easy. It's year, man. When you asked me a minute ago, "How long you been in the fire service?" And I said, 22 years, and you're like, "All career?" I'm like, "Shit, yeah, it is." Like, dude, I'm getting older, and it's wild to think that way, because I still enjoy the enrichment of learning and going out to classes and networking with people from everywhere to learn what they're doing, to bring it back, because it gives you the broader perspective of my thoughts on a lot of pieces of everything.
No, definitely. Okay. You're a huge fan proponent of engine company ops. So what caused that, or who made you realize, like, "Hey, I love this stuff. I have a passion for this."
I'd say, I mean, you got to give credit where credit's due. I'd always been eat up with it, but Aaron Fields really was the guy who was like, "This is cool." And just to see his and his cadre's delivery of the course of Nozzle Forward, a whole separate story of how we brought it into Charlotte. It was firemen doing fireman stuff. We didn't get a lot of backing from the department because of, again, because of my messaging and some other things. But we were able to adapt, overcome. We put 60 people at Gaston College through Nozzle Forward, and it changed our department. A group of us got it worked out and funding and all these things. And man, it brought passion to the engine craft in our department. It also brought engine craft to me, right? Like to what I was doing. And I think it's important for people to understand how important that is to find your niche in the fire service. If you're into ropes, cool. If you're into ladders, cool. That's great. But you got to have people in the engine, and the art that it really is really got me into the weeds and started me down a road of really just understanding what water does in fire. Not just put the wet stuff on the red stuff, but what it actually does. At a everything from a molecular level to physics to science to, chemistry, all that stuff plays into how we extinguish fires and how efficiently we can do it. And it's, man, I just nerd out on it. I love it. I laugh with Blake Cartier. He's a friend of mine. And I laugh because he's like, "Oh man, cutting a roof." I'm like, "Dude, I've done that a couple times, and it is nowhere near as cool as stretching a line and moving a line through a door. I don't think it's there." And it's funny because it is what it is. But I think it's important for people to realize that, like, to have that passion is okay, but don't, as Kyle said excellently in your podcast, that doesn't mean the other guy sucks. It just means I'm more passionate about it, man. And you talk to people that are, I mean, you get you going on something, or you get a guy at work going on chainsaws or whatever their interest is. Like, there are people at work, when you get them talking about something, it's like, "Holy crap, what did we start?" And it's that's me with engine ops. There's so much to explore, so much to look at, so many things to really get in the weeds with, and it's stuff I never thought I'd be interested in. In terms of like the science and the chemistry of it, and how water reacts with heat fronts and all the UL stuff, and it was kind of one of those, like, it was always hidden away, like, oh, you got to be a truck guy if you're into the fire service, or a rescue guy. And even in Colombia, the culture was you got to go to rescue one or truck seven to be, you're oh, that's where all the good folks go. And I just wanted to ride an engine. And then when I took, I always had that interest, but I'd say Aaron Fields really, just prior to taking that class, was around some really good folks with the Fire Service Warrior Group. And they were like, hey, read this book of Andy. I was like, okay, cool. We'll read the book of Andy. And I read the book of Andy, and man, just again, started down that road pretty heavily. So,
Okay. My last question I always like to ask the guests, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
I'm listening to your podcast all the time, and when you emailed me, said, "Hey, I want to have you as a guest," I was like, "Man, I don't know what to say." I'm currently in the division chief process. There's a couple positions coming open. I don't know. I could retire from Battalion 9 and be happy. I do think I have I'm pretty healthy, knock on wood, right now. So I got life left in me for operations. It's not that I want to get away from operations, but I think in any firefighter's career, there's a time comes that I start looking at the next step. Because one thing about me is I left some of my time in Colombia in the retirement system. And since then, I've worked at my volunteer agency, part-time when they hired full-time staff, and currently still am kicking on that retirement. So I will have to go somewhere in South Carolina for a few years to get that retirement, for longevity. But I can retire with my Charlotte retirement and a South Carolina retirement as early as 55, and have two pensions and my kids both be in college. And I'm not gonna lie, man, that's where I want to be. I don't know what it is, what ranks it'll be. I laugh, if I go up a step or two or whatever whatever Charlotte brings before I hang it up there. Man, I might go to a golf course and cut grass as long as he's got a state pension. Like I said, hey, Mr. Danny, what green you need me to cut today? And so I don't know. I like I said, I'm in the division chief process. I think that would be an interesting job. Getting to manage budget, getting to have a little greater impact in the department. I think that's cool. In terms of the next career, I see myself probably being a chief officer or somewhere in training in probably not a metro department, just because I'd like to be in the small department. I think you can affect a lot of change in those type of positions in smaller places. That's not to count out the metro departments, but I just think I have some things that I would like to share and be a part of. With a lot of people I've met, I've been super fortunate in the state of South Carolina. I work in Charlotte. It's one of the guys that gives me a hard time down in South Carolina. I said, you're the most famous South Carolina firefighter that doesn't work in South Carolina. But since I live in South Carolina, I've been very involved, and man, so many opportunities with the Firefighters Association in our state. And just the network I've built and met, and cool people at cool departments, and think, man, I'd like to be a part of that in the tail end, to kind of as the swan song as I ride off into the sunset, part of their change or part of their vision, that they're in the infancy now. So I think it's, some sort of position there. But most importantly, man, and I joke, and I think everybody will appreciate this, and my son won't, but I told my oldest son, because he'll be in college about the time I could double retire, and I said, man, I'm gonna come to your dorm or your apartment. I'm gonna sleep on the couch and go party with you. And he was like, no, Dad. And I'm like, I'm serious. And my wife was like, no, he's probably not staying here every day if he doesn't have a job. And I think that's Danny, that's kind of where I want to be, is I have my health, be able to be involved with my kids' lives post college. Come to their first house and aggravate the crap out of them, like all dads do. But help them build a fence at their first house. Help them hang sheetrock, even though I don't know what I'm doing. I know some people, right? Or paint their house, or just be a part of that part of their lives. And some of that is, that I lost my dad during that part of my life. So I think that's kind of where my passion is for that. I just want, my wife the other day said something about, well, you're thinking long term. I was like, honey, you do realize I could leave Charlotte in like 3.5 years. She's like, what? I'm like, yeah, like we're getting close to like some long term life planning. And so, whatever. I was having a discussion with another battalion chief who's in the division chief process. You never know where your career is going to take you. And man, the man upstairs really, it happens for reasons, and sometimes you don't know what it is. I've had a great experience with everything I've done in my organization. I've had great experiences outside of that, and I think I would really enjoy being a part of a good smaller organization once I leave our department. And what that is, I don't know. I think anybody who knows me knows I have a passion for training. I really enjoy training. Maybe it's being a training captain, right? Maybe it's just being a training captain and going out on the drill field and burning and working on drills and curriculum for recruits or whatever it is. Some of the coolest stuff I get to do in my department, yeah, I get to teach on my own, but is impact our recruits with engine ops and health and safety and some of the subjects. I get to get in a room of brand new people who are into the job. They're forced to be into the job, right? Because to keep the job, they got to be into it. But I just remember the instructors I had, and I think that may be where I land is somewhere where I'm dealing with recruits in some shape or fashion. Just because, I mean, what a time! I mean, we all remember recruit school. It was fun, challenging. You grew as a person. Time, man, just all the things that happened in recruit school, and I know some of those instructors impacted me, and maybe that's where it is, or maybe it's sitting in an office. Working on policies that help people out in the street do their job. Because I think that's, one of the cool parts of being a chief and being into the job is understanding the operational side, but also understanding the above me side. I think that's the struggle to bring it to because the communication is so tough to get that to the street. And maybe that's where I fall. So kind of in a roundabout way, I have no idea. I want to have fun. And I want to do right by the folks on the street, because again, I think that's part of, and I know I'm on here and you're asking me questions, but the any of us that are battalion chiefs or chief frontline chief officers in a department anywhere across this country that really want to embrace being into the job, it's our role to spread that word at a greater impact level. And I think that's, man, if that's my function, when I walk away, like I don't need. A lot of our chiefs had these huge retirement parties. I was like, dude, I'm probably just going to go home. I'm going to smoke a cigar, have a glass of bourbon on a fire truck bumper, because I've always wanted to drink on a fire truck bumper. Can't do it, right? I mean, I can. It's an option. It's just not really a good one. But at 6:01, I'm going to pop my 20-year Pappy on the bumper of a fire truck and be just a citizen and walk out the door knowing I did good. I don't need a bunch of attaboys and all that, I mean, most important thing, again, I read it again today, right? To the fire department, you'll be replaced tomorrow. There'll be a couple people happy when I retire, because guess what? Two people get promoted. But when I get home to my family and my kids can look at me and go, "Dad, you don't have to work tomorrow," that'll be a great feeling. Because I had a great discussion with Mark Von Oppen about this. He's kind of stepped away from his own fire department as he retired, and like he said, he feels like when you dump your passion into the fire service throughout your career, it's easier to step away because you're kind of tired. But you're like, man, I did everything I could during my career. And because he went back and taught a class after he was retired, and he's like, man, it was weird. I didn't really enjoy it. And he said it was fun to be around the guys, but it just felt different because I wasn't part of the organization. He said, man, I'm gonna do my own thing with leadership and my experiences. But he was like, I just feel like it's easier to step back when you've dumped a lot into the fire service, and you can look back behind you and go, man, I did good. And that's it. Like, you don't need the accolades and the back pats and the high fives. I mean, that's part of it, but it's more about it's exactly like what I said about my kids. When somebody comes up and goes, man, you raised a good kid, like that's fulfilling. I don't need a party but that's part of it, right? Is when you look back and people go, man, thank you. You impacted me, right? Danny, you impacted, I'm sure you've impacted people in your department. People have impacted me, and I've said that to multiple people when they've walked out the door, and particularly that deputy chief when he retired. I said, you changed my career. I don't think you know that, but I want you to understand, like, that simple conversation of you kicking me in the teeth and saying, hey, fix it, changed me. And I think that is one of the cool things, just to hear that and go, man, I did do good. You always feel like you're doing well in the moment, but just to hear that, that's more about me, man. Just hopefully I'm healthy. Spend time with my kids. Like, I've laughed, like, work at the bait shop, and my only decision is, do we have worms or not? Like, live on Oak Island, wherever.
Okay.
So
Love it.
I think that's me.
And If anybody wants to contact you, because we didn't go down this, but if anyone doesn't know, you're the owner and creator of Hornet Fire Training. So just a quick thing. What do you guys do? What can you bring? How can people reach out to get you involved?
Yeah, so in I guess it's been 7, 8 years ago, started the company. It was because a mentor of mine, Brian Brush, looked at me and said, "If you don't start a company, you're going to get your family sued." And he started yelling at me because I was doing hands-on training with no insurance and all the things that all firefighters do. And he's like, "And you're taking a beating at work because it's Jonah posting on Facebook." And I was like, "Man, whatever, this dude." And he yelled at me, which I had been part of the conversation when he started Fire by Trade, same reason. So I was like, "He's having the conversation with me." So I started it. It's Hornet Fire. We're on Facebook, Instagram. I've got a website. It's a WordPress website. It's not, I'm not a high dollar operation. We run, I just bought, I got a box of shirts sitting here. I don't even really sell a lot of stuff, but we do classes for departments. We do them at some weekend schools, do some conferences. A market that we really fell into that has been super impactful to me and super cool has been Sumter Fire Department contacted us about doing an in-service training with their department, smaller department. "Hey man, we don't have the bandwidth to do a good engine class. Could you bring two guys in and do it?" And we've done that from everywhere from Sumter to Greenville, South Carolina to Parker Fire District to, I mean, we got classes scheduled, Savannah area. We got some classes scheduled. And man, just to meet people across the state and give them a tool set within the engine world or truck world, man, it's super fulfilling because you hear the stories, you get the pictures, or you see the helmet cam of like, "Hey, what you showed us made us better." And it's not just snake oil and cool. Jonah gets a check and walks off and posts on Facebook some cool pictures. Like, we have been able to have an impact. We, not Jonah, we, my group, have had an incredible impact on our state. We offer, if you're in South Carolina, the Fire Service Improvement Conference is coming up. We do an engine school. It's 3 days. I've got 9 or 10 instructors, so you can imagine the individual attention and conversations that get to happen in a class of 30 with 9 instructors, 10 instructors. We do stuff like that, but like I said, the market we came into is a smaller department. "Hey, can you guys come do a engine in service?" And what it allows then in some of these smaller departments is that instead of the officer leading the training, then the training officers can evaluate or improve the company officers instead of the company officers just doing the training. So that's been a real benefit. We've done a lot of really good work, working from other good training companies too, and bringing them in to do supplemental training on other topics that they specialize in. And Facebook, Instagram, and again, Hornet Fire Training at Gmail. It's not real difficult. It's been super humbling, but, and I told you this, and I'm going to throw this out there because I think it's important. When I started the company, it was kind of about me, right? I'm teaching, I'm going teach, been fortunate to teach at FDIC and do some things. And it was about Hornet Fire and me. But then slowly it became about others that were teaching with me. And now I've got some people who in no way, shape, or form would come on this podcast, no way, shape, or form would post on Facebook. But they're the folks that are, that they represent the people in your department that you know who are the SMEs of whatever the subject. It would never be the front man. I'm the front guy. I've gotten to bring some people into the fold who deserve, some of them retired, who deserve to still be involved in the fire service and share their experiences. And that's been the coolest part is literally like the engine school. I'll have 9 or 10 people out there, and there's at least the second day, I don't do a whole lot of teaching. I walk around and talk to, some of the vendors and talk to some of the chiefs that are out there watching us. And I've got other folks that deserve to be that face of the organization, but don't want to be out there doing it. So that's been the really, really cool part of it is to be able to have a platform for other people that wouldn't build the platform. They're like, "Oh, hey, I'll get on the platform. I just don't want to be the front guy." And I'm like, "All right, because we know how the front guy gets, right? I'll get made fun of for something. So it is what it is." But
Okay. Joan, I appreciate you accepting the invite. Love the conversation we've had today. A lot of hopefully biggest takeaway, self-reflection. I think that goes a long way in any fireman's journey. Yes, we are all dumb, young, cocky. When we are coming up in the service thinking we know it all, but all it takes is that one individual that hopefully you can see when they pull you to the side and go, "Hey, you're messing up," like you don't take it to heart as far as Oh, well, I'm just going to brush them off, but actually listen to what they're telling you. And hopefully with age comes maturity. But I do want to say thank you for coming on and speaking facts today for sure.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And I just think that a lot of people don't get warned that there's going to be a time in your career where you need to get checked up. And you don't know when it's coming. You don't know what it looks like. You don't know who's going to do it. But that 7 to 10, 11 years in the fire service, I think everybody deserves a little throat punch because you're at that point. You think you know what's going on. You got it figured out. You know what the fire chief's doing. You know what this guy's doing. You don't know anything, man. You got to be a good soldier. You know, question when you need to, but again, that little bit of when somebody's like, and I hate that, the Dr. Seuss quote, another one I use is the, those who mind don't matter, and those who, don't mind matter. That one, right? That gist, you got to be careful with that because sometimes the people who do mind do matter. And the problem is, I can't tell you who that is. I can't give you a list of 100 names that matter. Cause you may be like, oh, he's always on my rear end about this. Like, hey, man, have you ever like thought? Maybe he might be right. So I think that's just a message that's not heard enough. And I mean, I would have talked about a bunch of other stuff, but Kyle hit all of it on the head a couple weeks back. And it's to the same points I'm making. Just, man,
Absolutely.
treat people as people. Everybody's a person, man or woman first. And the more we can remember that in the firehouse and the respect that that brings, I mean, everybody's got a family with a weird family member, and every one of us does. We still sit down at Thanksgiving dinner. And we still have family struggles that we work through. It's the fire service. We can't just go, I don't care. Because again, those team members matter in some way, shape, or form. At some time, they all matter. If we're
Definitely.
doing CPR and we don't teach somebody how to do it, or we don't teach somebody how to vent a roof, and the day I'm off, we need to cut a roof, like we've failed that person and the citizens. So
Thank you.
thank you for the thank you for doing what you do, though. I mean, I know a lot of people don't get to pontificate, but I'm gonna steal the mic from you. Like, all that you do not only gives me something to do when I'm driving, but it's a great message to the people you're bringing on. You know, and especially being from our region, I love that we're bringing a good flavor to the fire service. Something that you know, a lot of podcasts, it's just people yell, scream, they do this, they do that. Your podcast has always been one that I love listening to because it's down to earth, dudes. Just same struggles, giving a good message, and it's about the service. It's not about, you know, what I can, what Danny B is going to get from me. So I appreciate it, because I know this is a lot of time on you. I know we got to edit some of mine because I had to take a break in the middle. I know all the work it takes and the time. And man, I can't thank you enough for valuing time with me, but also for all the other awesome people you've had on here. So thank you.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you for the words. Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah,
Thank
you
you.
take compliments about as well as most good firemen.
No, I mean, I'm just like I really do. I appreciate because I'm telling you, there are days where like I'm just like, okay, I think I'm gonna be done here shortly. And then like yesterday, I got a DM, I got a message, a long message, and this guy stated why he loves it for and telling me to continue to do what I do because I'm affecting change, but I just don't. People that are trying to do positive things, they don't always get that reward right away. But even if it's just that one person that I can talk to and was like, hey, this got me through this situation, makes it all worth it. So I really 100% appreciate that.
Yes, sir. Thank
Awesome.
you.
Thank you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.